gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. And I'm here with Mike, my audio board engineer and sidekick. Good evening, Mike.
Good evening, Andy.
Well, today is October 2nd, 2006, and one thing that means is that yesterday was October 1st, 2006, the day that the Redskins played one of the most exciting games they've won at home in a while, Mike. So you must have been in hog heaven, Redskin heaven, sitting there in the stands.
Well, I tell you, it was just a good football game all around because no one team was in complete control for the duration of the game. It was back and forth. It was expected to be a defensive struggle, but it wound up being a shootout. And lots of touchdowns, lots of action, lots of back and forth, and, of course, the overtime. Three plays after overtime started, Santana Moss walks it into the end zone after getting a 58-yard pass from Mark Brunell.
Well,
and Jacksonville fans were quiet after that.
I suppose they were, but it's so strange to hear you mention Redskins and touchdowns in the same breath.
I know.
They've been a little shy on touchdowns for a while, haven't they?
They have been. They've got a lot of playmakers on the team. They've looked good on paper for the past year or two, and it looks like they're finally starting to gel as a unit, so we'll see.
They've had occasional games where they'd score in the 30s, but a lot of times it didn't mean anything. They drubbed somebody, you know, 30-3. These are the kinds of games where 36 points make a difference.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, so we're going to jump right into a big, big story in Washington. Normally, I like to ease into the politics, but we've got two major things going on. The first one we're going to talk about, because we are serious radio, not to be confused with serious radio, is the new Bob Woodward book. The second thing, of course, is the Foley sex scandal in Congress and whether or not Hastert and the rest of the Republican boys who found out about this, when they found out, and whether they hid anything and for how long and all that good stuff. So we'll get to that in the second half. And I've even got a couple of clips from some conservatives. There are conservatives defending it or rationalizing it. Not too many. Most of them are coming down pretty tough on this. But the bigger issue, really, politically, and the more interesting one, is Bob Woodward's new book. So Bob Woodward has come out with a third book on the Bush administration. And this book is called State of Denial, Bush at War, Part 3. And there are excerpts been coming out this weekend. The book's now number one on the Amazon.com. I don't know where it is on the New York Times. But I want to run through a little bit of this. So the first piece that was in the Washington Post. Of course, he's a Washington Post reporter with a reputation for getting his facts straight. The first installment on Sunday, just yesterday, was primarily about several things, but the biggest one was that the statements that the administration was making on Iraq were not consistent with the grim reports that were coming in from a variety of sources on the background. And it starts with mission accomplished, and it goes on to other things that were said, like Cheney's last throws. And that stuff's been reviewed. That stuff's been out there. What Woodward does that's different is Woodward is able to talk to the principals involved. He gets very senior, high-level people to tell him what happened at particular meetings. And he gets usually direct quotes or things that he puts as close to direct quotes. And then he doesn't put quotation marks on it. But you can be pretty sure if Bob Woodward says that he's talked to three of the four people at this meeting, and this is how it went down, a denial by the fourth person is not credible. And that's what's going on right now with Condoleezza Rice, our Secretary of State. There are several things to talk about, but what she was basically warned. The argument goes in the book that 2 months before 9/11, there was a, quote, urgent warning to Rice. Now, what actually happened was George Tenet believed, he was talking to his counterterrorism chief, Coffer Black, who's not reachable right now. I don't know exactly where he is, but he's not confirming or denying anything because nobody can reach him right now. I think he's out of the country or something. Anyway, they were going over the latest about Osama bin Laden. This is 2 months before 9/11. And Tenet had been pressing Rice to set a clear counterterrorism policy. Now, again, this is the story that Tenet and others are telling Bob Woodward. And he finally decided that there was no conclusive smoking gun intelligence, but that there was a huge volume of data suggested that something was coming, that Al-Qaeda was going to strike soon, possibly in the U.S. And so they asked for a emergency meeting. They met every week with him, with her, with Condi Rice, but they asked for a special meeting to highlight this, thinking that if they could convey the depth of their anxiety, as Woodward put it, then Rice would take immediate action and there'd be a plan put in place and we'd get serious. And who knows? I'm not saying we'd stop 9/11, but this is what went on in the first 8 months of the Bush administration. This issue, in a way, got kicked off by Clinton 10 days ago when he pushed back with Chris Wallace of Fox News and said, why do you always ask me why I didn't get Osama bin Laden in the 90s after the Cole bombing was declared Al-Qaeda's responsibility by the CIA and FBI, and I was out of office when it happened? Why didn't Bush go after him? And why, when my administration said terrorism should be your number one issue, did they poo-poo it? And that's in part what this book supports, because Rice was polite to Tenet and to Black, but they felt they got the brush off. That's the word that they used with Woodward, and Woodward uses in the book. So the idea is that people were warning the White House, particularly Condi Rice's national security agent, national security advisor, to get serious about terrorism, take action, set up some special task forces or structures in a hurry to deal with this. So that's one piece. Now, Rice is denying that this took place, but the problem is that Woodward has it in his book that this meeting happened on July 10th, and this didn't get mentioned in the September 11th Commission reports. For some reason, this meeting never came up. Rice didn't tell him about him, and Tenet and Black didn't tell him about it. So it's probably just an oversight. I don't believe there's a conspiracy here, but the details of this meeting will now come out. Now, my money's on Bob Woodward. If he's wrong, fine, point me and show me that he's wrong. But there will be more information about these issues, and I have to believe that Condoleezza Rice has dug herself into a hole on this, because she's the one principal there that, and she may just have a rule, I don't talk about this stuff, I just deny it. But I think her credibility's on the line. So that's one bombshell that was in the first installment from Woodward's book. The other one, as I mentioned, was simply, it isn't a bombshell, it is simply that the Bush administration put out good news and had a rosy scenario for Iraq all the time. They were getting grim reports. Now, we've known that before, so it shouldn't necessarily surprise us, but there's a couple of things in here that just are somewhat mind-blowing. One of them is that General Abizaid, the CENTCOM commander, was very worried about the situation in Iraq, that it was becoming a war that was not winnable, and that the public could tire of it and it could wind down before we're done doing what we need to do. But they basically saw the comparisons to Vietnam. And so Abizaid, what Woodward documents is a lot of conversation back and forth with generals. And it's really pretty interesting. And they're not that far from John Murtha. In fact, the quote in the book as much as says so. Abizaid sat down and said that as far as, it was Murtha that said that Abizaid raised his hand while he was talking to Murtha, held his thumb and forefinger a quarter inch apart and said, we're this far apart, meaning cut and run. John Murtha has pretty much the same view of what's going on in Iraq as General Abizaid. And that's why he's so certain of his information. You know, when he says, I've talked to the military guys, they know how this is going, we got to redeploy. That's the voice of experience. That's a general reaching out through a congressman. And Woodward is essentially getting the same story. Now, you could say, well, you know, Martha tells that story to everybody. What's Woodward got information that's special? Well, here's information that's special. It turns out that the other piece of all of this, and we'll get to it in probably not till the second segment, but is the issue of whether or not Donald Rumsfeld should have stayed at the after the 2004 election. It's a logical place to change some horses, and Rummy's credibility had worn thin. He'd made a number of misjudgments. He was seen as arrogant, etc. So all this comes out in the book. But it turns out that if you think about this whole thing, it isn't, I mean, people have been out talking about Rumsfeld resigning, and getting Rumsfeld to resign is not really the point. The leadership is still the leadership, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and they're not signaling a change in direction. So it doesn't matter who carries out policy at the Pentagon, except there might be some credibility restored. In any case, the most interesting thing for me in the segments that came out on in Sunday's Washington Post was this first Ford, Nixon and Ford administration connection. Everybody talked about how the Bush team was so good for the country, if you remember, because they had experience. This was the adults taking over. The Clinton clowns would be out, and these guys knew foreign policy. Mike, you've heard me before. I use the expression, the best and the brightest.
Right.
That's the expression from the Kennedy years. But that was arrogance run amok, and it got us into Vietnam. And the Democrats learned their lesson in Vietnam. The Democrats learned that you don't go into another country and try and fight an insurgency, get involved in their civil war, or try and settle things on somebody else's turf, because just like our irregulars during the Revolutionary War, you know, I saw the Patriot. I saw Mel Gibson kick some butt in the Patriot. You saw that, right?
Yes, I did.
And so you don't go into somebody else's country and think you can not only hold it, but win them over. Their first job is to drive you out. They will unite to drive you out eventually. Now, I'm not saying that's happening in Iraq yet, but this brings us back to the first Nixon, to the Nixon and the Ford administration and the first Bush and all his friends. And it brings us to Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld. So if you remember how George W. Bush chose his cabinet, he was looking for a vice president. He put Dick Cheney in charge of the search for the vice presidency. And Cheney came, I can only imagine, Cheney came back to Bush and said, you know, I can't find anybody on the list as good as me. Because Bush ultimately asked Cheney to be the vice president, and Cheney accepted, meaning Cheney thought he was worthy of the vice presidency, I suppose. So Cheney has been Bush's, I don't want to say puppet master, but Cheney has been Bush's conservative backbone. Not that Bush isn't conservative, but Cheney's the guy that's convinced Bush this is the right course. On his own, Bush would doubt himself, I think. I really do. But Cheney, the voice of experience, has been whispering in his ear and saying, this is the way you got to do this. So Cheney's the one that recommended that Bush hire Rumsfeld. Now, what's interesting, this book by Woodward goes back to that situation, and it talks about how when Bush was first thinking of hiring Rumsfeld and Cheney recommended him, he talked to Andy Card. There's apparently quite a bit of interviews with Andy Card in the book, which Card has confirmed in the last 24 or 48 hours. And Bush said to Andy Card, you know, I like Rumsfeld. I'm very impressed with him, having met him. And Cheney recommends him highly, but my father can't stand the guy. And it turns out that Bush's father didn't like Rumsfeld. And he thought he was overbearing and arrogant and all this stuff. And Bush had to decide, did he trust his father's judgment or did he trust Dick Cheney's? And he went with Dick Cheney's judgment, which I think is where the country went off track. If he trusted his father's judgment, I think the country would be a lot happier. And so one more connection to the Nixon-Ford era. And this is unbelievable. When we come back, I'm going to tell you who the primary advisor is to Cheney outside the government, the guy he turns to frequently for advice, and his initials are Henry Kissinger.
Hi, I'm Andy Finn, and I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
Richard B. Cheney swears that Pat lay in public like so much hot air. Insists he and Bush care, waits for the weapons, still thinks Iraq was a threat to the U.S. homeland. I can't understand all the Bush appointees. Where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Rabbit and Coulter writing the words to a book that reflects a strange fear. Who would come near? Look at her whining, blaming opponents and damning up dubious foe. Is it for show? All the right-wing parrots, where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Ah, look at all the angry people. Ah, look at all the angry people. Ambassador Bolton hates the UN, but now he is a part of it all. He's got some gall, push the divider, renominates right-wing judges, no change in his tone. And he's not alone, all the angry people, where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong?